using philosophy to understand our city and to change it. This is Phi on New York, the podcast of the Gotham Philosophical Society, with your host, Joe Beal.
The long wait is over. Phi on New York is back and hopefully better than ever. The aim, as always, is to bring you conversations that take a philosophical look at the issues and ideas that shape our city and inform our lives within it. For this first episode, I wanted to take a look at the idea of the right to the city, an idea introduced by the French philosopher Henri Lefebvre in 1968, and which was enthusiastically adopted by many activists and organizations, and has been so ever since. My guest for this episode is Margaret Quanzo, a philosopher at Long Island University in Brooklyn, who recently took up this idea and provocatively argues that to adequately understand any such right that we can claim over the city, we need to also acknowledge that the city itself has rights that we need to respect. I enjoyed this conversation immensely, and I hope you do as well. Margaret Quanzo, welcome to Phi on New York.
Thank you.
So I'd like to begin our conversation by asking you to discuss the book project that, the book that you published last year in 2023 called The City is an Ecosystem. And your background is in philosophy of paradox, or you've published a book on paradoxes, and I'm curious, where the motivation for this came from, what you were hoping to achieve, and if you could speak to the interdisciplinary nature of the project, we'd love to start there.
Wonderful. Well, thanks. Yeah, the book, The City is an Ecosystem, was co-edited by me and a few colleagues from Long Island University, Deborah Mutnick, Carol Griffiths, Tim Leslie, and Jay Shuttleworth. And the book is an interdisciplinary book that looks at some of the deep crises that we see of our time, namely climate change, biodiversity loss, and social inequity. And what we do in that book is we approach those three crises, which we see as interconnected, from different interdisciplinary perspectives. So Carol Griffiths, for example, is a retired biology professor, but she is also a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History. Tim Leslie is also a biologist. Jay Shuttleworth is an educational theorist. And Deborah Mutnick is a professor of literature. And taking these diverse disciplines and these and others, we put together this work that we thought could highlight the interconnectedness between these major crises that we see the world is facing today. So the book is actually the result of a grant that we had gotten from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Humanities Connections Grant, that was given to a program we founded called the Campus Urban Sustainability Program, CUSP. And so in it, we basically put together different experts from different fields, from education, from science, from sociology, from various other art, just general active community organizers. And the idea was that all these different perspectives would do something new with respect to these crises that we are facing. So we basically thought that given the complexity of the issues we're facing, more voices, more perspectives, the better. Now, my own perspective is, that of philosophy. So that's my part in this project, but there are others.
Well, thank you. Just get into the discussion of your particular contribution to this piece, which focuses on the idea of the right to the city, and you add a very intriguing wrinkle to that idea. The idea of the city as an ecosystem, which is in the title of this collection, that plays a very important role in your overall argument. Would you like to maybe start there by saying, what does it mean to say or to conceive of the city as an ecosystem?
Sure, yes. So the idea that a city is an ecosystem is sort of a central premise in the argument I make. So it's the first premise, really. It's, if you think of cities as ecosystems, and then you think of ecosystems as beings that have natural rights, then, it just follows from those two claims, it seems, that cities must have natural rights as well. So, but that first premise that cities are ecosystems comes from, I think there are really two ways we could argue that this is the case. The first is what when you think about just in terms of what an ecosystem is. If you think of like a standard definition of an ecosystem, it includes something along the lines that ecosystems are like they're a community of living beings interacting with non-living beings. So cities as ecosystems have things like a biotic component, which includes humans, non-human animals, plants, and so on, interacting with non-living things such as, energy, geology, water, things constructed within the system. And then you think about what cities are like. We sort of see that's something that is the case in cities. We do see that cities have they have a biotic component, right? They're living things in the cities. They're humans. They're animals, and so on. Fungi, plants, and so on. And there are non-living things as well. There's geology, there are the constructed things, there's energy, there's water, and so on. And so cities kind of conform to that general conception of what an ecosystem is. And that holds true in terms of other features of ecosystems. We often talk about ecosystems of having kind of a metabolism. Things come into the, come into the ecosystem and then they leave as well. And so they absorb certain things and let out other things. And we could certainly see that in cities with the resources coming in and maybe products or waste or whatever going out. So we can see a kind of comparison between, say, a forest ecosystem and a city in this regard as well. Now, in the case of a forest, maybe I should say is that we see it a little bit more self-contained. A lot of the waste, for example, that's generated within a forest is, basically put to use within the ecosystem, absorbed back into the system. But that's not true of all ecosystems. We see things like rivers where something begins at the beginning of the river system and is brought to the end of it, and so on. So I think that if we think of what it means to be an ecosystem, that cities have that component. They have people, they have animals, they have non-living things. There is a network between them, and so it makes sense to speak of the city itself as an ecosystem.
Okay, so that kind of gives, you could say, a metaphysical analysis of the city in terms of such a system. What is the implications do you see for that, particularly ethical or political implications? Why, what does it matter? What is the relevance or the payoff, we could put it that way, of seeing a city in this way?
Well, I think one thing that it highlights is that there is an interrelatedness between the elements of the city. You know, I'm thinking about sort of a parallel, some parallel examples, for example, to someone like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, you know, in altering the chemical component, you know, chemical structure, let's say, of a river changes the biology. If we put chemicals into the river, then there are effects to that, and life forms are harmed in many cases, and so on. And the same thing you could say with cities as well, that there is an interdependent nature to the features of a city, what takes place in a city. So, for example, just as someone may think it solves a problem to use pesticides that will eventually get into the river, we could think of that certain solutions to problems within cities also have kind of unexpected results as well. So, for example, increasing jobs, you know, sounds like a great thing within a city, but then that, you know, there are attendant, you know, problems that might raise. For example, housing prices might go up, traffic might go up, and so on. So I think thinking of the city as an ecosystem highlights the way that one feature and of the city or one aspect of the city will influence another aspect.
Does the idea of viewing the city in this way, like, how does it map on to our usual political and jurisdictional conceptions of the city? So like where like the municipality ends and you're outside of the city, does thinking of it as an ecosystem kind of blur that idea? Or does it go beyond it? And again, what are just trying to think about what some of the political implications that taking this idea seriously and acting on it might have.
Right. So then I think there are some political implications to this, you know, and that in some ways leads us to the next part of the argument, which has to do with, you know, the rights of cities, but it also implicates, you know, it implies some kind of responsibility for cities. It implies that the cities exist, you know, in relation to things outside of them. And we talked a little bit about the metabolism of a city, for example, and so cities have, you know, generate lots of waste and things like this. And so we might think of the kind of moral implications of cities shipping their waste to other places. So that might be something. Also, of course, there are the inhabitants of the city, and, you know, that not all the inhabitants have access to the good things that cities provide. And so there is a problem, let's say, with the free flow of the goods or the free flow of opportunities for people within the city. That too raises certain, you know, of course, political and moral concerns as well.
So there's two different
aspects of your argument in this paper, the idea that cities being an ecosystem have rights themselves, which is a, as I say, a very provocative idea, which I want to get into. But your last remark points in the direction of the idea of the right to the city, which is an idea, a philosophical idea that has a history and is in many ways kind of your starting point in the paper. And I'm thinking if we could go there now and then work our way back to the idea of cities having rights themselves. So could you give us a little background on the history of the very idea that there is a right to the city? What's the story behind that? What is the what does that mean? What could it mean? And then kind of how you build on that.
Right. When we first proposed this book to the editor, you know, the, one of the things that was often mentioned is that, you know, basically that, you know, there's something called the right to the city movement. And I was assigned the task of talking a little bit about that movement in the introduction and maybe having a chapter to, you know, making sure that that movement was discussed within the context of the book. And, you know, I dutifully began, you know, an explication of the right to the city. I started with, you know, the two classic writers on this, Henri Lefebvre and David Harvey, who, you know, very much, you know, who are very powerfully argue that, you know, that access to the city is a right that its inhabitants possess, and that they're often denied. Not everyone has equal access to the good things that cities have to offer, and this could be in the form of you know, healthcare or jobs or education or safety and other parks, green spaces, things like this. And that's often due to the fact that because of class issues or things like this, or race issues, or even gender issues in the case of safety and so on. And so the idea of having a right to the good things that cities provide is something that really caught steam based on their work. And so I began dutifully like discussing that. But when you think about that that argument, it's a good argument in some ways, but it often treats the city as sort of, let's say, a resource to be used in some ways. And that struck me as a little bit off. And also, it just got me wondering that, you know, if human beings have rights to the, you know, use, let's say, or exploit the city, then does the city itself have any rights? And so if we think of cities as ecosystems, and there right now there's a big movement, there are big movements to talk about the rights of nature and the rights of ecosystems, then you put those two together and it seems just to follow then that cities themselves have some kind of natural rights.
Okay, so maybe it would be a good idea to clarify the idea of rights and the idea that, or at least that are certainly in play here. So for someone like Lefebvre or Harvey, when they initially invoked, or Lefebvre initially invoked the idea of a right to the city, what is a right? I know that might sound like a very basic question, but I think it can be helpful just to try to, you know, kind of situate ourselves conceptually here.
Right. I think it's useful to hear in this kind of context to distinguish between maybe a natural right and sort of a political right or a right that's legally bestowed on us. So a natural right you might think of as something that is inherently due to someone or something, due to their, you know, to their nature. So you think about, this idea of inalienable rights, rights that can't be taken away from us, like rights to life, liberty, and so on. So those would fall under the category of natural rights, just based on who and, you know, or what we are, our own natures, let's say, our own, the properties we possess, the rights follow from those kinds of things. And that's distinct from, let's say, political rights or rights that are based on, you know, governments and things like this, that are, you know, based on what the law of, let's say, the land is. And those are bestowed to us by society or by through legal means. And so they're different there. So in the case I'm making, I'm focusing initially on natural rights, although ironically, we're starting to see more and more, and I just saw an article, I think it was the January 1st of this year in The Guardian. I think the title of it was like, could 2024 be the year nature rights enter the political mainstream? So it's sort of the idea that rights of nature, this might be the year for them. People might start talking about them. Indeed, you know, some recent articles I've been reading, you know, I just pulled up one earlier in which the rights of nature were recognized by Milwaukee or some county in Milwaukee, a town in Colorado a couple of days created a role of the role of a guardian of the rights of a particular creek, and so on. So we're starting to see, at least within the legal framework, this idea that that the natural rights of the ecosystem should be somehow codified into like legal rights as well. So
before we get to this idea that the city has natural rights and what that might mean, can we just kind of stay here for a moment and with this idea of the right to the city and the explication that you just gave about natural rights in terms of rights that presumably human beings have in virtue of what of their own nature, as opposed to rights that you have that are bestowed on you by the government. So is the right to the city a natural right, or is it one of these legal rights? And what is the city such that one could be said to have a right to it? And I'm asking that kind of independently of the idea of this kind of analysis of the city as being an ecosystem, but just what is the city such that Lefebvre thought that it's something anyone would have a right to, you know, the idea of a right that you have some sort of a claim on, or that you can make a demand which others either at the very least cannot interfere with your attempt to achieve it or possess it, or might even be obligated to help you. So is this right to the city that Lefebvre and then Harvey thought was, one, a natural right or a legal one? And two, can we speak about why anyone would think that you would have a right to the city?
Right. So in the case of Lefebvre, you know, the context here is, you know, and Harvey as well, context here is, you know, is a political one in which Lefebvre distinguishes between the citizens of a city who, you know, who live in it, who are, you know, intimately connected with it. And he thinks that, you know, that cities are, you know, they allow for these like moments of connection, and they allow for us to like basically express some central features of our own nature, some kinds of creativity that allows, that he talks about these moments of spontaneity where we just kind of we experience the city in its true nature. He draws a distinction between like the inhabitants of a city whose lived experience is in the city versus, you know, a different class that sort of treat the city as, you know, a place, you know, a repository for wealth, for example, or a place they just sort of, you know, come and go as they don't really live in the city as well. So for him, the citizens of a city have a kind of, you know, they have a natural right to the city that the city itself provides, not just things, you know, very simple things, but these moments of spontaneity, this expression of oneself, that it's a kind of community that we engage in. And it's something that follows from our own human nature. So it would count as a natural right.
So that for a human being to realize their nature as fully as they can, there's something about the city experience or being in a city that contributes to that. Do you want to go on as far as, you know, saying more about, like, in a sense, perhaps how the city does this in terms of providing for this sort of spontaneity, the heterogeneity of the city, that it is, and it's crucial that for the people who actually live there. And I take it that the argument of Lefebvre, and then certainly Harvey, kind of goes into kind of a greater detail, that, as you were saying, the people who perhaps use the city as a source of wealth, or who it is a place where they can come and go, make use of it, make use of some of its goods and resources, but don't, in the, I think the word that Lefebvre uses, they don't really inhabit the city in the way that its citizens, whom he focuses on the working class, do, that much of what happens in the city, much of how the city evolves, how it transforms continuously, the amount of development and redevelopment of a city, is too often for the benefit of the people who are not these true inhabitants of it. Is that kind of the core kind of criticism behind the right to the city, or that it is the citizens who really have a right to this city and to what make the city what it is?
Yeah, and he puts it in very, I don't know, it puts it in really, kind of, I don't want to say poetic kind of language, you know? If I have a minute, I can sort of put that, you know, sort of, I think if I could find a quote from him. Okay, so he talks about these the new bourgeois, right? Who can ignore that the Olympians of the new bourgeois, right? The, you know, this is my words here, but like the, you know, the people who don't really inhabit the city, they go from grand hotel to grand hotel or castle to castle, commanding a fleet or a country from a yacht. They are everywhere and nowhere. That is how they fascinate people immersed into everyday life. They transcend everyday life, possess nature, and leave it up to the cops to contrive culture. You know, I'm not quite sure about that last line, but the idea, but the idea of you know, this idea of these people who don't really inhabit, they're really part of the city in that real way. They stand as outside of it, you know, and it's hard to think of, you know, I'm a native New Yorker. I've lived in New York most of my life. And so it's, you know, I you know, that brings to mind, you know, many images to my mind as well.
You made this point earlier that one of the dissatisfying things, perhaps, if that's the word that you have found from looking at Lefebvre's argument, Harvey's as well, is this tendency to kind of think of the city as apart from us, that it is this thing that provides various goods, provides various resources, and that it's crucial, they think, that we emphasize that how people, particularly these inhabitants, the working class, have a right to it, and that they are not necessarily being permitted access to it. But your argument is that we need to go beyond that conception of the city. It is not this sort of thing. It's not this resource, but it is, there's something much more profound going on. And again, this brings us back to the idea of the, you know, the ecosystem.
Right, right. Yeah, I guess sometimes I wonder whether or not, maybe not so much Lefebvre and Harvey, but like the movement itself is treats the city itself as a kind of resource to be exploited rather. And that's a different way of thinking about a city rather than as an ecosystem of which we're a part, basically. So, you know, if we are the city. We are not the exploiters of this resource that the city is. So, of course, Harvey and Lefebvre are writing at a different time. The environmental crises that we face weren't really as, you know, profound as they are right now. So that's in some ways to be expected.
So do you want to shift over to this idea of the rights of the city that you've already, you know, kind of touched on and spoken of, but now kind of do a little bit of a deeper dive into this. What this idea that the ecosystem has natural rights of its own, this idea that nature has rights, so that in the city being kind of a natural thing, perhaps in this way, if that's right, what is it to say that a city, or, and we can broaden this as well to, you know, the idea of nature, the idea of animals, can other beings besides, or other things besides humans, be said to have rights? Is it a concept that travels beyond human beings?
Yeah, I think if we look at the history of discussions about rights, it's interesting because we see the concept, you know, and maybe, you know, the concept, if we think of it like a rubber band, it keeps getting stretched to cover more and more things. So, you know, we think about like early formulations, very early, you know, the rights of have to do with, you know, men. And then we see Mary Wollstonecraft come along and talk about, you know, the vindication of a right. She writes a vindication of the rights of woman. And a little bit later, we see, you know, somebody like a Jeremy Bentham, a utilitarian philosopher, arguing famously for the rights of non-human animals. And further still, we see, you know, throughout, we see cases made for children's rights and even rights for collectives. So the idea of a collective having a right. So not just the individual rights, but the rights of, let's say, a group or a culture. We see that as well. And we see rights for severely cognitively disabled in the case of Eva Kate, for example, or philosopher Eva Kate. We see it extended to even past and future persons, not only just the present people who are around right now, but people who have yet to be born or have died already. Annette Beyer has an interesting piece about the rights of the past persons and future persons as well. And so the notion of like what counts as having a right is something that's been played with throughout history. And I think as time has gone on, it's expanded. It gets expanded in the case of the rights for legal for natural objects. We see that some kind of argument for that emerging in the 1970s. But today we see a real proliferation of people standing up for the rights of natural objects. And so in a quick Google search will turn up things like the rights of a stream or the rights of the rainforest or so on, and the concept of of ecocide and that being a crime, you know, are all part of like the political discourse that we have right now. Maybe a new part, but it's still a part of that discourse. So I think that, you know, as time progresses, the idea of natural rights that apply to cities may, you know, even though it sounds a little bit paradoxical right now, that may not be so, you know, unusual, let's say, as time progresses.
You might well be right about that, and certainly everything you've just said in terms of the expansion of this concept and how it has been stretched. I think one of the philosophical questions to be asked is whether how helpful that is or how useful it is. Certainly there are kind of ethical ends that one might be trying to achieve. We don't want the river to be polluted. We want children or animals to be treated in a certain way. We don't want them to be abused. Is the invocation of rights necessarily the clearest way of doing that? Again, historically, the idea seems to have the idea of having a right, being able to make some sort of claim on others, or being able to exercise some capacity, and it being kind of ethically objectionable for others to interfere with that exercise, seems to usually have the correlative of responsibilities and duties. And if, for instance, animals have rights that we are to recognize, is it possible for animals to recognize the rights of other animals? That sort of idea. And so if the stretching of the concept breaks down, there's always this question, it seems to me, about is this the best way of conceiving of something that we might feel strongly about, which is that we don't want animals, just to stay with the animal example, we don't want them treated in a particular way. We don't want them abused. We don't want them harmed either at all or unnecessarily so or gratuitously so. But does that goal require attributing them rights? Does that help that to achieve that end? Perhaps it does, but this stretching of the concept of rights seems to kind of blur what, if there's anything particularly unique or special about the claim that one has rights. That's always been somewhat of a concern of mine. So I'm not sure we can solve that here, but if you want to say anything to that, and whether, you know, with respect to the city, whether, again, using the idea of the city having rights, whether that is, again, you think it's particularly helpful, it helps kind of clarify how we should be thinking about the city that we are a part of and about the various elements of it, including humans.
Yeah, I think we should think about responsibilities in the case of cities, but maybe not perhaps in the case of some things. I mean, I'm frankly okay with the idea that one does not need to reciprocate, that this idea of having a duty is necessarily a corollary to having a right. So, for example, children don't necessarily have any kind of duties or responsibilities that, as we, even though they have rights. I think that's fair. I think that animals as well, you know, you could be recipients of, we there are certain things by their very nature that would entitle them to certain rights. But that's a good point. We are stretching this concept pretty far. And, you know, I'm as you mentioned at the beginning, I'm a fan of paradoxes. And one strategy you could take in terms of this is to see it almost as a paradoxical argument. We've got, okay, premise, you know, so a paradoxical argument has, you know, you take two or more claims. They look very good. They seem obviously true, but yet the conclusion to be drawn from them is something that's kind of, you know, either contradictory or absurd or whatever. So you can maybe see the argument I'm presenting is kind of paradoxical in that I'm arguing that cities do have rights. I'm starting off with two premises that I think are pretty straightforward, that cities are ecosystems and ecosystems have natural rights, therefore cities have rights. But maybe what you could say is that, you know, what this shows is that one of those two premises have to be false because they lead to this kind of absurd conclusion that, for example, New York City has certain rights itself. And, you know, my own inclination is that the way to solve that kind of paradox is to say the conclusion is true. Yes, New York City does have certain kinds of rights. But you could say, well, maybe instead of rights, we should talk about, use a totally different framework here and just give up the concept of rights. The thing that I don't necessarily like about that too much is that, you know, in focusing on rights, there is that shift from natural rights to legal rights. And I feel like it's more, how shall I put it? It's more active, let's say. There's more of an end result with, and like it or not, we, you know, rights are part of our own political framework. And there's power in talking about rights. And so that's maybe why I'm sort of inclined to keep the rights talk, because it is tied to law. I mean, if once we get from natural rights to political rights. So that's my own inclination, though.
Well, I think rights talk, I agree with you, is very powerful. And my own kind of metaphysical views, like normative metaphysics, is that when it comes to rights, they exist so long as we believe that they exist and that we act as though they exist. And so the argument, you know, arguments in favor of rights or arguing that this is my right or this the city has rights, to the extent that it that the argument succeeds in persuading people to act as though, then that's then it has rights. You've kind of bestowed it in that way. I think that's kind of a crucial kind of realizing rights. If we ignore people's rights, if we treat them as if they have no rights, then in all practical purposes, they don't have rights. You know, they can make claims, but if those claims are falling on deaf ears, then they don't have them. So it is absolutely crucial that people kind of hold on to the idea that they have rights, that they and that these become kind of institutionalized. So, you know, I see the power of arguing for it, but I love the fact that you say that there's kind of these kind of paradoxical implications to making this move. And I guess maybe we could kind of start winding the conversation down by maybe talking about a couple of those and get what you think about them. You mentioned that, you know, when saying that the cities have rights, you mentioned a few of them. You said that they have a right to exist. They have a right to kind of freedom from or harm, to be resist being harmed, and a right to freedom and self-determination. I guess maybe starting with that last one, right to freedom and self-determination, this struck me immediately as kind of raising issues about jurisdictional authority over cities. So, you know, kind of that given the city has rights of its own, it requires a certain degree of autonomy in order to determine itself. How do we then think about, say, just staying with New York, you know, but you know, any city in perhaps anywhere, but how do we think about the authority of Albany? How do we think about the authority of the federal government, which can intervene or with various decisions that people in the city might want to make? Are they violating the rights of the city when, you know, when the governor or the federal government says, no, you're going to do it this way?
It's possible. It is possible. I would think, you know, I think of the parallel of, you know, the rights of a citizen versus that of, a state, for example, or a community, or, you know, so this city, if the individual has rights, but, you know, the community in which that person finds themselves is capable of violating their natural rights as well. So, and also those rights are not totally, you know, they're restricted in some ways. The rights are, there are inherent rights, but, you know, there are restrictions that are placed on cities as well and individuals as well. So it's not a free for all, let's say.
No, I was just wondering if the city could argue for secession, you know, from the state, if not, or the nation, based on you know, based on their right for self-determination.
I think it's in principle possible.
We'll see if it becomes
maybe
necessary.
We'll see how things go. New York.
I guess one kind of last thing I would like your thoughts on as we kind of reach the end. It seems appropriate to explore how this idea of the city having rights and the idea that of having a right to the city. How does that connect up with, for instance, New York's right to shelter and the current migrant crisis, the housing crisis? How do you see or approach these problems the city is facing from this lens?
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, you mentioned that one of the rights that a city might have would be something like the right not to be harmed or something like this. And I think when parts of the city are denied access to housing or whatnot, then that's restricting the flow, let's say, of elements within the city, and it's causing a kind of internal harm, an internal bottleneck. Think about like a dam, damming a river, or blocking something in the forest to prevent a certain animals from entering or something like that. I think that issues about like accessibility in particular are part of the rights to the city. And we can think about them in terms of the city having a right to not be harmed, not have its movement, its internal movements restricted, and so on. So I think that it's part, you can see anything related to accessibility, the access to the good parts of the city, as being translatable into the right of the city to have free movement within itself and to not be bound, let's say, and constricted by some outside force. A healthy city has a free-flowing movement within it. So that's one way to think about it.
Could an argument be made, though, for being concerned about, just thinking about the influx of migrants, that that if this is if it is not stemmed, mm-hmm. Or if there is not help being provided by the federal government or other cities to alleviate some of the burden, yeah, that they represent a harm, or that the crisis itself represents, I guess, as the very word crisis suggests, is a harm to the city.
I think it is possible, you know, introducing too much of any one element into an ecosystem undermines it. So an overabundance of something is the more than the system can absorb and handle and produce and, you know, and integrate would definitely be something that did harm to that ecosystem. You know, I'm inclined to think that the city, you know, just has a lot of resource, can incorporate a lot of, you know, I think of New York as a city of immigrants and city of, you know, being accepting to refugees. But yes, I think in principle, at least, that there can be an overflow of refugees that would harm the city.
Which, of course, would then lead to the question of who has the obligation, or how that obligation to protect the city, how that is spread around. What does the city mm-hmm. need to do in order to address this, to alleviate the problem? What role does Albany have? What role does Washington, D.C. have that if this, you know, ecosystem is being, you know, inundated, is suffering from the crisis, how can it be alleviated? And of course, alleviated in a way which doesn't violate any of the rights of the people who are coming to the city. So a
correct
deep ethical questions there.
Yeah.
Margaret Quanzo, this has been a wonderful conversation. I've enjoyed it immensely.
So have I. Thank you.
Thank you for coming on.
And that will do it for this episode. This podcast is a GPS production with theme music composed and performed by Jay Sparrow, titled Voice Work by Sport Murphy, and logo artwork by Marianne Beal. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this conversation or any of the others, and welcome your suggestions for future topics and guests. You can contact me through social media or by email at jsbeal@philosophy.nyc. Thank you for listening, and I hope you join us for the next one.